Welcome to New Mexico People, Places, and Ideas. I'm Stephen Spitz. Today we'll look at one of the big issues facing green energy, namely energy storage. Our guest is Abbas Akil, the principal member of Sandia National Laboratory's technical staff for advanced battery technology and battery testing. Sandia, it will come as no surprise to listeners, is recognized as a world leader in this area. Abbas Akil, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Steve.
Abbas, I'd like to start with the electric car and energy storage, and then in the second part of the show, talk to you about wind and solar power and its energy storage,
sure.
Okay? But when it comes to the electric car, I assume that if a battery were cheap enough and light enough and could hold a big enough charge and could accelerate, you know, cause a car to accelerate quick enough, a lot more of us would be driving electric cars than we are today. So if you look at cheap, light, storage and acceleration, where are we today basically with batteries for electric cars?
We are getting there. We do have much lighter batteries. So if you recall, the first electric car made by General Motors was the EV1, and that had a lead-acid battery.
Yeah.
It was about three times heavier than the batteries we have now, and much shorter range. And another issue with batteries is if you discharge them and charge them many times, the life of the battery goes down. Just like your car battery in your car, you keep starting your car every day, you use it. After 5 years, there's no life left. And the battery still looks the same outside, but the inside material is all used up. So that was the lead-acid battery that General Motors started with. There was a transitionary battery, which is the one that is used in the Toyota Prius, which is a nickel metal hydride battery. It was a little lighter, better on the cycle life, but what we are using today is most of the lithium batteries, which are even lighter and should give us much longer lifetimes. So
really the origin of the hybrid, which is a electric gasoline a car combined, right? That's really to make up for the battery problems.
Yeah. Because if you rely entirely on the battery, especially with our American driving habits, you know, we expect a car to at least go 300-400 miles on a tank of gas. The same would be true for a battery. People would expect that if I charge the battery once, I should be able to go 300-400 miles. The reality is that with lead acid, we could hardly go about 80 miles. That was back in the early 90s. Now the range has improved, but the compromise of the hybrid was really made so that you as a user would not feel this limitation of range. So you won't have to stop and charge for 8 hours, 6 hours, 4 hours, but keep driving as long as you have gas in the tank, just like a regular car. And the engine gets a boost from the battery, both when you're trying to start from stop or go a little faster or overtake somebody, the battery gives the extra boost. And that's how Prius gets maybe, 47, 50 miles per gallon.
And the Prius has been far and away the most successful hybrid in the United States. I assume around the world.
Around the world. It was introduced by Toyota before it came to the U.S., about 3 years before, 4 years before it was brought to the U.S. and Europe. And they put a lot of road miles on it. They were very confident of the technology. And they brought it to the U.S. And really, that technology has not had any serious recalls or anything.
I mean, they say they're in their third generation, but what's the third generation?
Tremendous difference. It's the first model introduced in the U.S. It was a little kludgy under the hood. You could tell it was still not as refined. So the third generation is pretty silent. And if I go on a highway, it drives like a regular car. The old Prius, you could see it struggle.
So I guess that answers the question why the Prius has been so successful.
Yeah.
You get the same driving experience.
They kept it totally transparent.
Now, there is an all-electric car on the American market, right?
There is now. The Nissan Leaf is all-electric, and the Mitsubishi i-MiEV is going to be all-electric. That has not – it's been introduced here in very limited numbers, but the Nissan Leaf is available, I think, in several states now. I saw several in Hawaii.
Now that uses the lithium ion battery, right? That yes. You mentioned earlier.
That's right. Uses the lithium ion battery.
And there's Prius is supposedly coming out with a plug-in hybrid and the Volt a plug-in hybrid, correct?
The Volt is a plug-in hybrid too.
Yeah. So obviously there's a reason why the Volt and the Prius hybrid plug-in are using these different batteries. And what is that?
We characterize that as energy density. So per pound of weight, you have more energy packed into the lithium-ion battery. So it's lighter and carries a bigger punch. That's what you want in the battery. And, of course, you want longer cycle life. And lithium-ion gives us both. So the lead-acid battery was heavier per pound, didn't give us as much punch, and I could only draw it down and charge it up so many times. And then it was dead. But lithium keeps going for a longer time. But lithium is a much more expensive material. The manufacturing is also more expensive because, remember, lead acids have been manufactured for the last 150 years, literally. So they have had the advantage of going down that cost curve. They've been produced by the million, whereas lithium is still a new technology.
Yeah, and that I want to talk to you about that because I'm sure you're aware that that the United States government put a lot of money into the stimulus package to sort of cause lithium-ion batteries to be manufactured here. I think in 2009 when that happened, U.S. was producing maybe 2% of all lithium-ion batteries.
That's correct.
The idea now is to ramp it up to maybe as much as 40%.
Yeah.
And the concept is this is the new wave. This is what's going to drive the car industry. And let me just stop right there and ask you, what do you think of that?
I think that's a very essential move because lithium-ion, all the lithium family batteries were pretty much produced either in Japan, China, or Korea. There was virtually very little manufacturing in the U.S. So if we want to maintain not only a lead, if we can capture the lead and maintain our position, we have to bring the manufacturing back home. And this was a good investment, I think. Not only is it timely for the jobs it creates, but brings the manufacturing base back into the U.S.
Well, if you just tuned in, this is New Mexico People, Places, and Ideas. My name is Stephen Spitz, and I'm talking today with the technical advisor on advanced battery technology for Sandia National Labs, and we're talking about energy storage and the electric car right now. And I want to ask you, part of the argument for why the U.S. needed to do this, bring the technology back, was that sort of the electronic manufacturers in the 60s decided that they'd be better off, even though the technology came from the United States, would be better off
as it
in Japan
does.
and in Korea. Is that true?
Yes.
That's true.
Yeah.
Okay. And then the argument is, well, Japan and Korea sort of combined their companies with all this government subsidization, and so our poor car companies couldn't really compete, and so they needed the extra help of the United States government to fairly compete against the Japanese and the Koreans.
Yeah, and I think this is more of a policy issue because somehow we don't support the manufacturing side. Our federal investment or research investment by the government is really made on the R&D side. And it pretty much cuts off there. Then we leave it up to industry to take whatever technologies that the government researches or develops. And then it's up to the private sector and the competitive market to say, all right, which one do you want to pursue and where do you want to take it?
That's been a fairly successful. I mean, that's really what Sandia does, right?
Yeah. We produce new R&D that then
manufacturers
adopt. Exactly.
I mean, that's been a successful thing for this country. But you're saying in other countries, actual manufacturing subsidies.
But there's a very good relationship or a tighter relationship between the government programs and the manufacturing sector. Sony, Mitsubishi, Hitachi, they all have connections to the agencies in Japan that are responsible for economic development. They can get contracts from them and they lay out longer-term plans. where they conceived the technology in its very, you know, initial incubatory stages. Then they carried through or hold the hand with the industry. There's a handshake with the industry to carry through manufacturing. So many of our products that we have seen, there's always a collaboration between the manufacturing side and some government entity, at least in Japan. I'm not that familiar with the Chinese infrastructure, but certainly Japan, that's pretty common.
So there's kind of an alternate version of this story that I've heard, which is that, you know, in the 80s, and I think Sandia was actually involved in this, there was all this research done by Sandia and the big three, or at least the big two, Ford and GM, into the electric car. And you know, the idea was that we were going to, and the Who Killed the Electric Car, if you've seen that movie, is all about that subject.
Yes, the
idea was, you know, there was an EV1 that you mentioned earlier, an electric car that GM only leased, decided it couldn't support, took back all the cars off lease, and literally crushed every car it could get its hands on.
That's true.
So the alternate version is, it wasn't that the Japanese were so clever and took advantage of this technology that was ours, that was abroad, and that was supported by the government. It was really the American car companies just blew it. And actually, Rick Wagoner, I saw, said that was his biggest mistake while head of GM, that he didn't support the electric car.
And that is true. Historically, that is true. Because he also said when the Prius was introduced that this is basically a marketing ploy by Toyota. This car will disappear in a year or two. And he could not have been more wrong. Time proved, and the events as they unfolded proved, that GM really sort of gave up their vision on the transportation side. And the Japanese clearly saw that the trend would be for not just cheaper cars, but more fuel-efficient cars and smaller cars. And yet GM went down the path of producing the biggest cars they could, the Hummer. Is a good example. I mean,
when people say, "Well, that there was more profit in those cars,"
there may have been corporate-wise.
Yeah,
but did it really help GM in the long run? Is the question.
Well, I guess the bankruptcy suggests it didn't help
exactly.
it all that much.
So it's unfortunate that he took that view, because instead of recognizing that there must be some, not some, that there's a reason that a respectable competitor is pursuing this technology. Instead of looking at closely, not examining just the technical side of it, but the philosophy behind it, should have been what GM should have done.
Well, I want to ask you one more question about something you said earlier, which is, and this was kind of the rationale for putting the, and it's billions of dollars of stimulus that's going toward the lithium-ion battery and its manufacturing. And the idea was green jobs, and you mentioned jobs, but I haven't done extensive research, but when I looked at like A123 batteries, which is, I think, the largest U.S. manufacturer,
yes.
I mean, they're employing hundreds of people. I mean, GM, I think, right now employs 200,000 people.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it seems like it's a very automated, not very labor-intensive process producing batteries, but I don't know. I'm asking.
The process for manufacturing the battery itself is very automated, undoubtedly, because of the materials you're handling and the kind of the process itself is almost like making a computer chip. There's not a whole lot of the, you know, grungy. For example, if you look at a lead acid production line, there's lead dust. I mean, it's a much more dirtier process.
Yeah, I mean, these guys are wearing bunny suits.
These
right?
guys are wearing bunny suits, basically.
Right.
You can't touch anything.
The manufacturers in the plant, right?
You can't touch anything. You can't, you know, you can't drop even a speck of dust. So it's a very clean, sterile process. It's not labor intensive, but what it does is, it's almost like building selling a home. You know, my wife is a realtor. That means when a developer builds a home, it is not just the people who are working on the home. But the appliances that go into it, the lumber, nails, you know, everything else, the tools. So there's an entire flow-down effect or trickle-down effect. So the battery manufacturing itself, the plant might be running on a fairly lean, non-labor-intensive process. but what the battery supports and the product that then comes out supports a huge amount of labor base.
And the other part of the argument is you sort of create an industrial commons. That is, now yes. The technical achievements back here, the technical engineers are back here, the science is back,
here. And everything.
Right.
So instead of just doing the science and letting it go, now we are completing the cycle, which is probably another mistake we did, was we used to do the science and the R&D and let the manufacturing be wherever it is most efficient and cheapest to manufacture, which was always overseas. So now we are bringing that back, and this is one step. And if you do this across industries, yes, it'll be very beneficial for us.
So there's an obvious problem with the electric car, right? And the obvious problem with the electric car is you're essentially hooking up to a coal plant. And coal is very dirty to produce, mm-hmm. and is very when you heat it up, it throws a lot of bad stuff into the environment. So when you're talking about a green car, I mean, how green is it when all the energy you're getting from an electric car is dirty, right?
That is one way of characterizing it, yes. you can say, all right, I'm plugging in the car here, and the wire goes back all the way to San Juan, and it's a coal plant. On the other hand, if I plug in the car at night when San Juan has to run at a lower level, it actually benefits the coal plant. Because then I'm not running it at a lower setting, this was the classical argument made to support the electric car, was let us charge all the cars at night so we can run the coal plants and the gas plants at a more efficient setting and make them more efficient, less pollution. On the other hand, now we also have a large contribution of wind. We have a large contribution of
solar.
And
that's what I really wanted to get to with you in the second part of the show, which is, you know, if on the other hand, we can make a bigger if electricity is more produced by wind and solar than it is by coal, now you really are getting green energy out of that car. But my understanding is that with both wind and solar, there's a real problem with energy storage. But before you answer that question, I'd just like to mention that this is New Mexico, People, Places, and Ideas. We are talking with Sandia's battery guy, Abbas Akil, who is sort of the technical expert at Sandia on batteries. And isn't it the case, Abbas, and I've heard some wind people argue to the contrary, but isn't the case that really with both wind and solar, you need some kind of storage if wind and solar is going to be a big part of electricity production?
So let's go back a little, step back a little further. What you're saying is absolutely right. Both wind and solar are what we call intermittent resources, which means I can't dial up and say, all right, give me 300 megawatts of wind for the next 15 hours. I can't do that. I can do that with a fossil plant which burns coal or natural gas. I can say, all right, give me 500 megawatts, till 24 hours. That's fine. Neither wind nor solar can do that. So which means I really, if I want to use this resource all the time, somehow I have to make a lot of it and I have to store it. But the same was true for nuclear power plants. So when nuclear came in the picture many years ago, there was a need because nuclear power plants like to run at their set point, one set level, for as long as possible.
So what's the variation between, say, peak and off-peak production?
In some utilities, I work in Hawaii, it's 1:2. So the nighttime production might be down to 80 megawatts. Mm-hmm. The peak might be 160 megawatts.
Wow.
So the turndown ratio is 1:2. On the mainland, depending on service areas, it may not be as severe. But it's still pretty significant. So what happens is, if you imagine the 24 hours of the day, then the largest coal plants or nuclear plants are run at a constant setting. We want to run them at a constant setting. That's how they are designed for. They are not designed to go up and down just like you drive a car. These are plants that are literally meant to run like a 16-wheeler truck. You just let it go on the freeway and you keep running it for 16 hours at a constant speed as best as you can. Whereas everything else is running on natural gas or some other fuel source, and these are smaller plants, that what we call peaker or load-following plants. So they make up the difference. So as your load changes during the day, these come on or off, and they're easy to what we call cycle. I can shut them down, I can turn them down. But you don't want to do that with coal or nuclear. So in order to address that, you know, 30, 40, 50 years ago, we had installed what was called pumped storage. The idea of saying, all right, how do I capture this much energy and store it? Instead of letting the plant go up and down, I'll let the plant run at a constant setting. I'll take the excess and I'll store it. And the only most efficient and cost-effective way it could be done was to create two large reservoirs of water, one at a lower level and one maybe 400 or 500 feet higher. And you pump water during the night when you want to absorb the energy, and you pump water from the lower reservoir and store it in the upper reservoir. And then when you need it during the day, instead of letting the plant go up or down, you let go of the water and recapture that energy and make it into electricity. This is called pumped hydro. But there was a lot of environmental opposition because you're using up water. Now, of course, you're not using it up in that sense. It's going from one reservoir to the other, but there's a lot of losses due to evaporation. But the largest impact is land use, because you essentially create two man-made lakes, an upper lake and a lower lake. And these are completely out of bounds for any type of boating, recreation use, nothing. You can't do anything in these because the water level fluctuates as it goes up and down. And you don't want, you know, obviously there's a danger for people to get sucked into the machinery. You don't want any marine life. You don't want any vegetative life. So this is dead water between the two lakes. Well, about the 80s, there was sufficient environmental opposition, and we stopped building these.
So sufficient to make it too costly to site these lakes? And
too costly.
Relative to the benefits that electricity companies would get from using it during the off-peak hours.
So there was enough of a detriment for a utility to say, should I take on this, you know, battle with an environmental and a licensing and a permitting battle for the next 15 years with an uncertain outcome, why should I even try?
So that leaves batteries, battery guy.
That left batteries, exactly.
Yeah. And the problem with batteries, I think, is that there's a heck of a lot. I mean, you're having to store one heck of a lot of energy.
Yes. And so when we started thinking about battery storage in lieu of pumped storage, that was a concept we had. Was we'd build these large batteries. I mean, you know, the original concepts of some of these were just amazingly large buildings full of batteries. That idea obviously did not prevail. I think the largest battery in the old days that we built had 8,000 batteries in a large room in Southern California. It's a place called Chino. And even that only gave us 10 megawatts. 10 megawatts is a very small amount of electricity. And for 4 hours, that's it. I had 8,000 batteries. So typically now the batteries you find are in the, you know, 2-3 megawatt range. I mean, there are some still built. In fact, Hawaii is going to be installing a 15 megawatt battery.
And that's something you're working on right now, right?
We are working on that right now. So, but this is more compact footprint. These are not the lead-acid batteries that I just referred to with the 8,000 batteries. In fact, these have more number of cells, but the footprint is even much more compact. So I can put 1 megawatt hour, which is 1 hour of storage, in a 40-foot container. And that includes the batteries, all the power electronics, and, you know, some of the monitoring, switchgear, all fits into one container. So the footprint has shrunk substantially. But even so, I don't think that we will use more than, you know, 10, 15 megawatts at a time.
So does that mean that as wind becomes a greater and greater presence, that we're actually going to have to throw away wind energy?
Which we do. Which we do even today.
Already we're throwing away wind energy.
We are throwing it away.
Meaning that we can't offload it onto the grid.
No.
And we just have to get rid of it.
Because the shortcoming of the grid is, and most people don't realize this, but basically when you switch on a light switch here, it's one small light bulb. But somebody else, I'm relying on somebody else to switch off their light bulb the same time you're switching it on. So in a sense, everything balances out. Because the electricity I'm producing in the coal plants and the natural gas plants has to be consumed instantaneously. That is how the electric system runs. It is basically on demand, right down to the kilowatt.
No storage.
No storage. If there was storage, life would be very different because we would have other ways of running our plants more efficiently and other ways of using our plants. But today, there's no storage at all. So when your fridge is coming on, I'm hoping that your neighbor's fridge is not going down. I mean, it's a balancing act. It's almost like a tightrope act.
So we're nearing the end of the show, Abbas, and what I'd like to do is pull out your crystal ball and sort of tell me where you think technology is going, say, in the next decade, both for the electric car and for storage of wind and solar energy. Where do you think we're headed?
I think the hybrid technology we have today is definitely a transition technology, but it's transition in a very long term because electric cars are here to stay. I'm pretty confident of that. But they do require a little bit change in habit of a change in our expectations of what a car does. It is very likely that we will keep improving storage technologies. There might be other technologies that come along besides batteries that will be able to power an electric car for even longer times or longer ranges. So this mode of transportation and what drives it will certainly change.
When it comes to wind and solar, I guess I find what you had to say very troubling because if we're going to have, as we increase it, it sounds like we're going to have to throw more and more of it away and we're not going to be able to store it.
So this is an interesting change that's also coming around. As I said earlier, there was a great deal of opposition to pumped storage in the 80s and very early 90s. Now, that is changing, too. In fact, even as sensitive a state as California is to environmental issues, there they are now considering pumped storage again. So maybe it is an accommodation. We want to be green. We have to accommodate some things that we have held sacred. So this is something just that we have to do. I mean, to give you a point as an example, Europe has 19% and 13% of storage. Japan and Europe, they have 13% and 19% of storage of the national grid is made up of storage. In the U.S., we only have 3%. Just 24,000 megawatts of storage countrywide is all we have.
Well, we're going to have to leave it there. I would like to thank my guest so much today, Abbas Akil, who's fresh off a red eye from Hawaii. Abbas is the technical project manager for batteries at Sandia. I'd also like to thank so much Tristan Klum, who's helping me above and beyond the call of duty today. My name is Stephen Spitz, and you've been listening to New Mexico People, Places, and Ideas on KUNM. Podcasts of this and other locally produced shows are available at KUNM.org. Archives of my prior shows are available at the Spitz Report on the web. Thanks for listening. See you next time.